Blog Talk Radio. So welcome to Firefly Willows LIVE. This is a very special Jubilee broadcast. It's our 50th Sunday morning show.
Now, we had something else planned for this morning. You're probably expecting Healing Conversations with Mildred Lynn. She'll be back next month, the first Sunday of April. But for today, we thought we'd take the opportunity to share with you some of the highlights of our previous programs, a little from each of our Sunday hosts. So with you this morning to MC this program is myself, John Carosella, and...
Hi, this is Deb Carosella.
So we're going to do one of our occasional segments, Fire and Water.
Throughout the show,
so don't be surprised. But in any case, what are we going to start with?
Today I think we'll start with an interview Mildred Lynn did in April of 2012 with Lynn Fang. And we chose this interview because of the time of year, and it's pretty apropos, especially for those of us living out here in California.
Yeah, almost springtime.
People are starting to get thinking about what they want to do in their yards and in their gardens, and Lynn talks a great deal about composting
and worms.
And also she includes things about upcycling and reusing, so it's a very sustainable approach.
Yeah, so this is a segment on being green and sustainable.
Correct. And it's very appropriate, and it marks Mildred Lynn's trademark light, open, fun style.
All right, well, let's listen in.
Herself as a conscious business coach, a writer, and a scientist. Lynn, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mildred, for having me on the show.
When we first met, I was really intrigued by you because you are one of those people who actually had an ah moment. Not only have you had an ah moment, but you chose to harness the energy of that and transform it into something that you could go forward with. Can you tell our listeners a little bit of what happened to you when you were sitting in your class in university and all of a sudden the lights went on? And perhaps you'd like to touch a little bit of your background as a scientist.
The very last class I took at college was called International Rural Development. And it was all about food issues in developing countries. And at this time, I was majoring in molecular and cell biology, so I was very hardcore science. There was very little of the humanities and social science and things like that. So this was one of the first classes I had taken about international issues. And so we learned all about how peasant farmers were being mistreated by big ag companies, and they were given loans that they couldn't repay. They were getting hooked on things like chemical pesticides and fertilizer because the big ag companies would offer it for free at first. The farmer would try it, and then it would work. It would make their crops go bigger and faster, and so they want more of it. But at that point, the companies would start charging for it, and they'd keep raising their prices. So farmers would get into debt.
How did that make you feel? Was it something that you knew about or knew about in the peripheral?
I was quite horrified by everything that I had learned, and I had never really heard about this before, especially in a classroom setting. So it came as quite a shock. I felt really terrible, and I had to question everything I believed up to that point.
And was there a specific example or story that really touched your heart and your mind? Because I'm thinking other young people are sitting in classes and probably having a similar experience.
I would say it came after that because this was the starting point where it opened me up to learning more about sustainability. And it was really reading Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, that really turned on a switch for me. In that book, he talks about all the issues of the food system. He believes the solution is that people migrate from cities to farms to take back control of the food system. And it was basically almost like a call to arms for young people to really join the movement in sustainable agriculture. That was the turning on point for me. I felt, oh, hey, maybe there's something I can do here. so I went for it.
Lynn, can you share with our listeners what your worldview was before you started to become educated in this area?
I must have had some vague idea that the way that we were doing things wasn't right. I was aware that factory farming was going on, but I didn't really do the research. I was kind of scared to really go into that area and really research it, and because you know that you're probably going to be horrified by what you find. So I was like most people, I didn't really want to become aware. I wanted to be happy being ignorant.
Yes, I think everybody has been there, and maybe some people still are.
Yeah.
So you're there and you're learning this information. It touches your heart, and then you decide you want to do something with this information to make the world a better place for yourself and for other people. What was that process like?
It was a gradual process. Once that light turned on for me after reading Michael Pollan, I wasn't really in the position where I felt empowered or I didn't have the confidence to really do anything on my own. So I spent a few years just learning as much as I could, reading books, researching online about sustainable policy, sustainable agriculture, and things like that. And eventually when I felt like, oh, I want to really do something, I felt like I needed to live sustainably in order to feel really in alignment with my cause and that calling. And so that's why I started my blog, was to get support for green living.
And your blog is called Upcycled Love. How did you come up with that name?
Oh, it sort of just came to me. I was really interested in upcycling. I thought it was a great idea. And upcycling is basically just taking something that would typically be thrown away. Like if you have a bunch of old clothes, you're either going to throw them away or donate them. But instead of doing that, you take it and use it to make new clothes or use it for some other use. So upcycling it to become something, a new product to use.
Would buying clothes from a secondhand shop or a vintage clothing shop, would that come under the category of upcycled love? Because I know I do that and I love what I buy.
Yeah, buying from a thrift store or buying vintage, that's definitely upcycling. Oh, it's more like reusing because you're not changing the original product at all. But once you make alterations to the original product, that becomes an upcycled product.
I got you. So when I add a little artificial fur trim to my new sweater and make it into a purse, then that would be upcycled.
That would be upcycled.
On your journey, Lynn, were there role models or people who inspired you? Because I imagine as you've walked down the path, you've probably looked not only to get more knowledge or information, but looked for people who were activating what you wanted to activate.
Yeah, I almost want to say everyone inspires me. In the beginning, I wasn't looking for so much inspiration as I was knowledge and confirmation. Now I look for inspiration. So people like Michael Pollan, he's an amazing leader in the movement. Paul Hawken is also an environmental leader. He has written a book called Blessed Unrest, which is very good. And he's written a number of other books too. And my teacher at my last class in college, his name is Eric Holt-Jimenez. He has a really great story where he worked for 25 years in Latin America as an agroecologist helping peasant farmers develop sustainable solutions to grow lots of food. And then he came back after 25 years to work in food policy. He's still very passionate and very hopeful about everything that's going on.
What institution would that be specifically in case someone wanted to look him up?
He teaches at UC Berkeley. And he also is the executive director at Food First, which is based in Oakland in the Bay Area. It's a think tank for developing food policy.
Okay, thank you. And I wanted to share with our listeners the website for your blog, Upcycled Love. Can you share that, please?
Go to upcycledlove.com. That's upcycledlove.com.
I really like the name of that. And I understand that you have an online composting course that you're going to be offering. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that? Because I know that for myself, composting is something I feel like I should be doing it, but I never actually take a real step. So if you could share your philosophy and a little bit about the course, I'm sure people would be interested.
Yeah. So I watched this one video on YouTube about building a backyard compost pile, and it was funny because they said too often people think composting is like rocket science, and they have video footage of space shuttle launching. I think that's how a lot of people feel about it. It's like a big mystery to everyone. Because I learned about the biology of it, I took a compost biology course from a soil scientist, and so I feel like understanding the biology of what's happening in your compost pile can you really help you get to know what's going on in there. So then you know why you have to turn it, you know why you have to add water, and you know why there's heat coming from it. That's very motivational, I think, for people to start a compost pile.
Do people name their compost piles?
You can.
Maybe to personify them or make them human-like, and that might increase the probability of relating to them. I don't know. Just a thought.
And I understand, like, the scary part about composting. You spend all this time building a compost pile or a worm bin, and then you're, like, going along, feeding it, taking care of it, and then it gets kind of tricky because you're afraid that, oh, what if it gets moldy? What if my worms die? And that those types of things really discourage people from continuing to maintain their compost.
Now, if you were going to offer someone one or two hints just to get them started, what would they be?
Let's see.
Other than signing up for your online course.
Yeah, definitely sign up for my course. Don't be afraid to go look at it, to go check on it, even if you have killed worms in the past, if you have screwed up your pile in the past. It never hurts to just go look at it, check on it, and, you know, if you have a question about it, go ask somebody what to do with it. And the one thing that is really important about compost is it's all the microbes in it, the bacteria, fungi, nematodes, all the things you can't see. Those are the things that are decomposing the food. Even in a worm bin, it's still the bacteria and fungi decomposing the food. Mm-hmm. And then it's the worms that eat the bacteria and fungi.
So worms are our friends. Fungi is our friend. We have to learn how to start to look at it like that.
Yeah, they are our allies. They are our friends.
I understand that on your journey, you wrote an e-book. Why did you write that, and who were you hoping to touch with your book?
The ebook is called Living the Transformation. It basically follows my journey of wanting to live green and then finding that I had all these old bad habits engaged in me that were coming back to take over. They wanted to stay in control. Sort of a combination of practical tutorials on how to make your own natural non-toxic cleaners, how to upcycle, how to compost, and how to live green, basically. Also, sprinkled throughout are some nuggets of inspiration in the form of poetry or some article that focuses on growing confidence and feeling resilience to whatever negativity is coming your way.
So when people are on this journey, and I know many people are waking up to the environment and how it impacts their health and how it impacts the health of their children and their community and whatever, are there any role models that you can share or websites that you can direct people to start off?
One of my favorite role models is Joanna Macy. She has a very wonderful website at joannamacy.net. And she provides also sort of a holistic approach to social change activism. She incorporates a very spiritual message as well as the activism message. Vandana Shiva is also a huge role model of mine. She has an organization called Navdanya, which is connecting farmers and people to the earth. And she also has combined science, spirituality, and philosophy together for empowering people.
Lynn, would you be able to put a list of resources or favorite links together if you just post that on the Firefly Willows Live website?
Yeah, sure, no problem.
Because I know that people check that out after the show, so that would be wonderful. I'm sure as you went on this journey, you had feelings about the state of the world and healing and lots of thoughts like that. What type of messages did you give to yourself so that you felt hopeful and you were able to transfer this hope to people who maybe read your blog or read your book or even people who are entertaining the idea of taking your composting course?
One really important thing is that no one person is going to save the world. It's going to take a whole lot of people, maybe not everybody, maybe like 5 or 10% of the population to do something about it. So you can be a part of that 5 or 10%. You don't have to be Dr. King or something like that. You don't have to be the one superhero of the world. And it's also important to remember that the outcome ultimately, because it depends on a group vision, that the outcome is not your responsibility. So it's important to just focus on what it is that you do want to create and just sort of let go of fears and doubts and being overwhelmed and just focusing on the little piece that you're working on.
That's excellent guidance. You're out there on the front line. You're interacting with people. What messages are they sharing?
People have written to me. They're very inspired by my work and they want to live sustainably. I know that a lot of people have trouble with it, and so they really like that I'm spreading this message and going forward with it.
And what gives you a sense of fulfillment?
Oh, I feel fulfilled when I am in a good mood. Being fulfilled is also being on purpose, doing something meaningful, feeling connected to a larger purpose that other people share.
With your background in science, has that helped you as you've moved forward in the eco or green area? How have you been able to tap into that and use it?
While I was working in biochemistry, I had access to PubMed articles and all sorts of research databases. So I could access a lot of articles, research articles that most people couldn't. That allowed me to do more research than the average person could. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say I was an expert necessarily, but is definitely more aware than most people. And also because I had an understanding of science, so I could see whether a study was done not well or if it was done well. And one thing to look for if you're trying to do research on your own is to see if the author of the study is tied to any other organizations that may be influencing their work.
Oh, I understand. Stakeholders.
Yeah, stakeholders.
That may color.
Now,
are you planning to write anything about the scientific approach to eco or green living in terms of what you've just shared now? When people are reviewing studies or reviewing data in general, make sure that there's not, how can I say this nicely? Maybe you want to say it nicely for me.
No ulterior motives
that might be coloring anything in any respect. It seems to me that you would probably be in a unique position to put 10 tips or some guidelines together for the average person.
Yeah, sure. I could definitely do that.
I think we might have just come up with something here. Lynn, is there a big demand for the type of service that you're offering? What I'm really getting to is if someone wanted to work with you on becoming more green or exploring their world and how they can improve it, how would they go about doing such a thing?
Well, I offer a variety of coaching services, mm-hmm. And I'm open to working with people on whatever they want to that fits in with what I'm offering. And what I offer is anything from conscious business, which is really just developing an online presence so you can start selling your services or products, you know, an authentic sort of heart-centered marketing plan. I also do copywriting and branding work and a little bit of graphic design. I also have sustainability coaching. So if you're looking to start living green or if you want more resources, guidance on living green and how that impacts your health and how you can save money by living green, things like that. I also offer that coaching as well.
And what do people seem to be most interested in?
Honestly, most people are interested in the business and marketing aspect.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's hard for people to feel like they should spend money on a green living coach because they feel like maybe the information is all freely available online. The good thing about a coach is that you get emotional support and someone who can filter through all that information online and point you in the right directions to the sources that are credible and reliable.
So, well, that was an interesting conversation between Mildred Lin and Lin Fang on sustainability and recycling.
Yes, it was. And I think now we'll take a quick little break and go to our public service announcement for the month, and then we'll be back.
All right, very good.
Firefly Willows, LIVE, is proud to support Hidden Villa, a nonprofit educational organization whose mission is to inspire a just and sustainable future through their programs, land, and legacy. Hidden Villa stretches over 1,600 acres of open space in Los Altos Hills, California, about 40 miles south of San Francisco. Purchased in 1924 by the Duvenick family, who established a nonprofit trust in 1960 that continues to today. Hidden Villa provides summer camps, school programs for pre-K through 12th grade, public programs, sustainable agriculture, volunteer opportunities, and internships to the community. Discover things to do at Hidden Villa and how to donate at www.hiddenvilla.org. This tip of the week from Hidden Villa's Environmental Education Program. It may seem weird to say this, but the best birds to learn from are not exotic birds like Chilean flamingos or crested penguins, but the ones in your backyard. Get to know your avian neighbors, what they like to eat, where they build their nests, what their songs sound like. A great way to do this is to set up a backyard feeder and bird bath. What are the species that are most common in your neck of the woods?
So, from sustainability and recycling, we go to renewal, but this time with a little magical coaching from High C, as he shares a magical moment segment from his Revolution with High C program on Easter Sunday of 2012. It's his Easter egg magic technique.
We did this exercise with High C during one of his Even You Can Do Magic evenings when we had our store open in downtown Los Altos, and it was quite fun. I do remember that the hardest part of the whole exercise was when we came home and trying to find a place to hide the egg where it was hidden, and but you wouldn't find it too soon or you would never see it again.
That's right. That's right. Okay, let's listen in as High C does his magical moment.
We begin this episode of Magical Moments with a quote by the Persian poet Rumi. Anything born in spring dies in the fall, but love is not seasonal. At this time of year, we're celebrating Easter and spring, today being Easter Sunday. And this reminds us of the cyclical nature of regeneration, renewal, and the rebirth of life. This is a time of conception, fertility, and new growth, and it's a really good time to work magic that is related to new and renewed beginnings. Some examples of that might be, say, you want to bring in new love into your life, or perhaps a renewal of love if you're in a relationship of some sort. Bringing in a new child into your life, whether it's to get pregnant or to stimulate energy around an adoption. It may be that it's time to embark on a new career path, or perhaps you want to move into a new home or study something new, or you feel it's time to dedicate yourself to a spiritual pursuit or a path. Actually, the possibilities are really unlimited and are only limited by you. Some things that you might want to think about or some questions you might want to ask around this time of year are, what seeds have we carried in us that are ready to open? What has been clarified? What insights or goals or needs have come out of this winter for you, with the winter having been a time of reflection, and now we may have a clearer sense of what it is that we want to start or we want to do or we want to bring into our life in the coming year. So this is a time to stop planning and to start doing. The winter was really a planning time. That's when, for example, let's say that we're thinking of a garden. That's the time when we're allowing the ground to rest and we're thinking about what it is that we want to plant once spring comes, what new seeds, what new plants, what new vegetables, etc. But now that spring is here, instead of planning, it's now time to start doing. So we want to take all of those ideas that have been brewing for the past few months, and we want to make them come to fruition by infusing and enhancing them with the energy needed through a simple magical technique, and this is kind of an Easter egg magic technique. You still have to be a proactive part of the process as the year progresses in order to see these things come about, because the universe works on a matching contribution system. If the universe sees you doing your part, then it will make sure to do its part with and for you as well. But if you think that you can just ask for something and then you just sit back and wait because now you've stated your intention or wish, now we just wait for the universe to bring it to us, that's not really going to happen. A little bit of magic can actually help to give just that right amount of energetic oomph to help you truly and fully manifest your desired goal or intention. Again, doing the magic infuses it with energy that supports and helps it to come to fruition, but you have to be a part of that process rather than thinking that the magic will simply do it for you. So this particular Easter egg magic technique has a few materials that you will need, so let's talk about those. First, you'll need one or more plastic Easter eggs, those little Easter eggs that you can get that you can like fill with candy or something like that. They're very easy to find. Also, one or more small pieces of paper and a pen or colored pencils. And, you know, how many of each of these things you're going to need is dependent on how many goals, how many intentions, how many seeds you feel you want to plant for the coming year. There are some things that correspond to this time of year, and none of them, I think, will be a surprise. So, for example, colors that correspond to this time of year are bright primary colors like red, yellow, blue, and the combination of those. Think of Easter egg colors because, you know, this is the time of year when we see plants and flowers starting to bloom. Think of April showers bring May flowers, so we're anticipating seeing all of the colors of the new flowers and the new vegetation coming in. And it tends to be a very bright and colorful time. So if you want to use this correspondence to help enhance the magical technique, you might use paper or eggs or pens or colored pencils that are corresponding to these colors in order to just bring a little bit of that color energy and color magic into this process as well. Gemstones or crystals that you could associate with this year that are really good, that would be helpful for this are quartz, selenite, and angelite. Trees that often are associated with this time of year because it tends to be their season, if you will, are hazel, forsythia, lilac, and willow. And herbs that you could associate with this year are dandelion, milkweed, dogweed, fennel, and dill. Now with the gemstones, the trees, the herbs, you could take one or more of these and you could add them to this technique in order to help bring a little bit of that energy and enhance that magical aspect of it. And you don't need a lot, you know, but what you'll end up doing is you could put a little piece of the stone with what it is that you're doing. You could include a little piece of the wood or a little piece of the leaf or a little piece of the flower of the tree. You could take a little bit of the herb or something and put it in as well with it. You could also, if you want with the herbs especially, you could get the essential oil and you could use the essential oil on the outside of the egg or on the paper in order to infuse that particular energy into this process. So it's really up to you if you want to use any of these or not. The main things that you would need for this at the most basic level are the plastic egg, the small pieces of paper, and the pen or colored pencil to use to write on the paper. The other things are just additional items that you can use to enhance and add to the energy in some way. So once you have all of those materials, then you can sit down to do this process. I'm going to walk you through it. If you want to do it right now, you can, even if you just want to grab a piece of paper and a pen and write down the things that are part of this process and then get the other materials later. Or you can play this back later in the archive and do it once you have the materials in order to set this intention and start this magical process for yourself. So this is really something that we're going to use in order to set some goals and intentions for things you want to plant that you are looking forward to seeing come to fruition in the coming year, or at least to get started growing and cultivating those. Even though they may not come to fruition this year, it doesn't mean that we can't start the process now of something that we're seeing is now needed or wanted in our life. I'm going to have you just take a moment to relax, clear your mind, bring your focus and intention and attention to what it is that we're going to do, and I'm going to walk you through a slight meditative process, but it really is helping you to establish what it is you want this particular magical intention to be focused on and to do for yourself. Close your eyes, take a breath, and bring your focus to your mind's eye or your third eye. A quote by Chopra Yoga says, "What seeds have you planted? What dreams did you bury long ago? As the spring earth begins to stir with life again, connect to the quiet within you. Root down into your potential by sitting in silence or taking a walk in the park. Now is the time for rebirth. Ask your intuition, your inner voice, your spirit guides, or the universe to bring forth images related to new growth, new opportunities, new goals that are needed at this time in your life. As images, words and actions come to you through your intuitive process, write down on your pieces of paper one or more areas of growth and actions to take that you can begin cultivating in yourself and in your life at this time in order to be in harmony with the growth and new life taking place in and around you. Close your eyes, take a breath, and meditate on what you have written down. See that growth taking shape. See the actions needed being taken in order to bring ripeness in the year to come to those goals, intentions, and needs that you have set. Take one or more of the empty eggs and fertilize them with the growth and actions you have written down by placing the paper inside the egg. Bring the egg with the paper inside close to your mouth and whisper your intention or goal that you have written into the egg so that it is not only filled with the paper, but also with your words of intention as well. Once you have done this, close the egg. As part of your celebration of spring and Easter, hearkening back to the egg hunts of childhood, hide this egg somewhere in or around your home. Then, forget about it for a while. At some point in the year, you may come across it again. When this happens, open the egg and remember the growth you had envisioned taking place in your life. You might want to think about these questions when you come upon that egg. How has this growth manifested? Have you taken the actions you wrote down? Is there still growth or actions that need to be done? Are you able to see what you have harvested in your life as a result of this growth? These are questions you may or may not have answers to at that moment, but the discovery of the egg and its contents can serve as a reminder of how fertile you and your life is, and how we are always growing, evolving, and fostering new growth in ourselves and in our lives at any given moment throughout the year. Be at peace with the growth that takes place within you and in your life, no matter how it opens and how it ripens, so that we might foster peace within ourselves, so that we might cultivate peace within the world around us, and so that we might fertilize peace in the world at large. I hope that this magical moment has been both intriguing and useful and beneficial for you, and I hope that what you find in the coming year is the fullness and ripeness of the fruition and manifestation of the goals and the intentions and the needs that you are planting at this time. Until next time, may your life continue to be full of magic, and may blessings surprise you around every corner.
We've added to our lineup of lively, thought-provoking shows. Be sure to check out The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Lutmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. More than just a call-in show, Heisey and Charlie will bring a new and unusual perspective to the power and capacities of the Tarot. Also join us for A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella. On the first and third Tuesdays each month at 8 p.m., John will bring together leaders and explorers in neo-shamanism. Practical and practiced, his guests are not just doing shamanism, they're living it. And don't miss What's Your Prescription for Balance with Mildred Lynn McDonald and her co-host, Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday evening of each month. They'll inspire you with the leading trends and best practices of holistic living, alternative medicine, and life coaching. This vibrant duo and their amazing guests will help you energize and balance your life from the top of your head to the tips of your toes. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows LIVE Presents for these new shows and our original Sunday morning Firefly Willows LIVE anchor shows. And welcome back. We're very excited about those new shows coming up. Be sure to check them out. We hope that you enjoyed Heisey's Magical Moment in the segment before. And there's so much more of Heisey and Mildred Lynn and John's offerings in our archives. Make sure you check those out as well.
Very good. And speaking of magic, we can manifest magic and mystery in our own lives when we play. And that's the topic of our next segment. That's a conversation that I had with Wendy Marie and Raina Satori in the August Convergence program about the power of sacred play and dance. Let's check it out. So with me this morning are two very special guests, Wendy Marie. Wendy, tell us a little about who you are.
I started a shamanic disco, which is a conscious, ecstatic dance. It allows a safe space for people to explore more of who you really are. Dropping out of judgment is a big doorway to walk through, and it's a practice. People come back weekly. So it's definitely a gathering of community and conscious practice. And for me, getting called into this place of community, like we were sharing earlier about really feeling the pain myself and seeing and feeling the pain of others, this lack of connection, this lack of trust, buildup of judgment and fear, and actually disabling us out of community. And I want to do an actual cultural shift. And so being a part of that, being called in to found a shamanic disco and Club Conscious, and then also director of Ecstatic Dance Silicon Valley, inspired by the Oakland dance.
Awesome. Great. And also with us this morning is Raina Satori. Raina, tell us about you.
I'm a dancer, a performance artist, and clothing designer. And I'm somebody who has been using dance as a modality for my own personal healing for the last 10 years. And I've also been a performance artist, and it's quite fitting that I would be working with Wendy, who's created a shamanic disco, because I am a shamanic cheerleader and have created essentially a medium for levity to come through to the masses. Our motto and our credo is, if you want to be enlightened, you've got to lighten up. So I shamanic
sounds like a lot of work for me.
We can help you. I do that, and I also teach a form called contact improv. Contact improvisation is essentially it's a very playful form. I like to describe it as like partner dance meets tai chi meets wrestling, and it's a way to surrender to the here and now, into the mystery of play.
So with that in mind, I want to talk about dance, but I want to talk about dance as play. I mean, is it possible that dance is not play?
Well, I think that there are definitely all kinds of places where dance is not play. Any stylized form, ballet or jazz, modern, ballroom dance, a lot of those forms not everybody, but some people approach those as a profession in such a way where it becomes work and it creates a large amount of suffering because there's a story that you're not doing it correctly or you're not good enough. And I would say that that's not necessarily play, but those forms can be play if you're in a place of sort of surrendered enjoyment. What do you think, Wendy?
So I have an immediate response and experience about that. You'll often hear me say, this dance thing, it ain't no joke. It's serious business. And some people will laugh when I say that. And I'm not sure if they're laughing at me or laughing with me because they get it. Or and other people will just be quiet and I feel like they get it. This is serious.
Is anybody quiet because they don't get it?
That could be, dang, another thing to consider. I don't want to consider. So help me not consider. But I do take it as very serious business. I'm an intense person, and I don't mean business as in monetary. I mean like this unfolding of authenticity through free-form conscious movement, this deep inward experience that people are literally cracking open, whether they're cracking open into their playfulness or cracking open into an experience of intimacy and soulfulness, or whether they're cracking into just this presence of owning their own anger, their sadness, their joy, but that we are learning to celebrate all of who we really are in a community through movement and music.
Why does movement and music provide, why and how? I mean, sometimes the why questions are a little bit harder to answer, but why and how does movement help crack you open?
So why and how, and I love that you addressed how as a different kind of question.
That's the freebie.
So what I notice is my experience, especially in Silicon Valley, is I am constantly in straight lines, left turns, straight ahead, backwards, and I'm disabled through that kind of movement. I'm in a square box. And what this freeform movement allows me to explore places within me and outside of me that I would never explore in my daily grind of life, whether it be family responsibility or work, but the way that we know it, the way that we've learned it, these straight lines. Even in a parking lot, I have to be very careful in Trader Joe's parking lot. I might connect with somebody. I might hit somebody. And connection becomes this place of carefulness. Don't get too close to me in the store or in the parking lot. So this allowing of this jellyfish movement, this flow, it's like, for me, dance cracks me open because it's the first time in my day that I get to allow myself to move freely. I have freedom. And so for me, creating a space where people can let it all go, where do we do that? Where do we get to do that other than in the dance and have a community hold us to freely express through an embodied practice? So that's the experience that I get in cracking open. It touches me deeply where my daily routine in life doesn't allow that penetration in that depth.
Why and how does dance crack you open? Well, dance is one of the very first things that humans did together as a form of community and prayer. Ever since the beginning of time, dance is the thing that people did to connect to the divine. So it's in our DNA that we move to experience an altered state. Also, you know, more modern science shows us that a lot of everything you've ever experienced in your life emotionally is stored in the soft tissues of your body. So when you move your body in a dancing kind of way, or even it happens in yoga, stuff comes up because the memory of it is stored in your body. Responses that you had physically to traumas when you were younger, they're still in there. And if you release that by moving, it will come up and be cleared out. It will be let go of. So that would be the how, I think, because when you move the soft tissue of the body, it will release whatever stuff is hanging out in there. It could be stress. It could be trauma. It could be joy. It could be pleasure. It could be unbelievable ecstatic happiness. But it's all stuck in there. Until you move your body, it won't actually move through you.
That's really cool. So there's an opportunity to break out of habituated patterns that dominate our work life. In engaging in dance, it's sort of called for to step out of the rigidity of the forms, so to speak. And in breaking out of the rigidity of the forms, we are circulating and stimulating the soft tissues of the body to, in a sense, on the one hand, you could say purge. On the other hand, you could say free the memories that are stored in the body.
Yeah, and memories and emotions. I mean, just let's take an example of like, okay, you're in your car. Somebody cuts you off. You feel upset and angry about it, or you feel scared because you almost got into an accident. And what happens in your body? It tightens up. You're like, oh, right? Or your kidneys tighten up because you got a scare, right? So that's going to stay there until you move it. So you have to move it somehow.
And physically moving the body is a way to move it.
Yeah, absolutely.
At least wake it up to the, you know, it's almost like I'm seeing it as a, what is it?
Like? Well, you know, if I may cut in, it's like water. It's like water, okay? It's like it stagnates until you let the dam open, right? So it gives you the opportunity to express the emotion that you are having. The reason why we contract physically is because we're trying to prevent ourselves from expressing an emotion that we're having. So when you uncontract, the emotion moves through, just like the stagnant water moves through, and it just moves out so that more energy can flow through you.
Yeah, and we're water anyway, right?
Right.
So the analogy is particularly appropriate.
Yeah.
So I just want to share, like, for me, what I'm experiencing in my body right now, I just have so much excitement and fire and passion around sharing this, and it is hard to put into words, and I so want to invite people into that courage and any curiosity that anybody might have to come and experience being in your own body, what that's like, this body wisdom that we have that is so often shut out, that we're in our head all the time, which is insane to lock out our body wisdom. And that this part of dance is reawakening us. It can be scary, and that's the exciting part of it. It's like standing in line for a roller coaster ride. Until you ride one, you're not sure if you want to be on it or not. But also expressing with words is a challenge. This experience within our bodies, enabling that and having a community that is on that ride with us, that we do agree we have bodies that need to be reawakened. And this allowing to have a full human experience, for me, what dance has done and movement has done and doing it with community, learning to just breathe and listen deeply and have a space that's safe to do that. I don't know where else I'm safe, but to have a space that's dedicated to just listening to our body wisdom.
That's what you craft with the shamanic disco.
Yeah, that's what we all craft together. You know, I produce it, but that's what we all craft in a community together. That's what makes it so deep and powerful, that allowing to have a full human experience and let whatever it is move through.
So what is it that people struggle with? What do they come in with that makes it hard for them? Or conversely, what do people come in with that makes it easy for them?
I have one word, judgment. Judgment for ourselves and others. That's the big disabler, not allowing.
You said two things. You said judgment and not allowing. How do those two relate? How do you experience them as relating?
My judgment disables me. It cuts me off from feeling because it attaches story. I feel angry. Oh, well, anger, that's not beautiful, and I'm a woman, so I need to cut that off right there. No, I'm going to find a happy place. Or, you know, so I dismiss myself and others from having a full human experience when I'm human. I have anger. I have sadness. I have joy. And to me, ecstatic means, like we call it an ecstatic dance. For me, ecstatic means depth. And so my judgment will cut me off, whereas in the dance and movement, we allow safe space to let go of your judgment. Notice it. Dance it if you want.
So judgment causes us to selectively exclude aspects of ourself, and that's disabling.
I feel that, yeah. I have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I experience other people when they share their journey of embodiment, of letting go, of allowing. You know, I think that's why there's a lot of drinking in our culture, right? To shut that down, make it stop. When we don't want it to stop, we want to notice it and allow it to move through. And as the music entices us and seduces us into our truth, to allow that tribal essence, our humanness, to be allowed so we can let go to that truth, which to me is ultimately a loving, accepting place.
We find that place when we fully exist in our bodies.
It feels like that to me when I own my full experience. Mm. When I brave my judgment around I'm an angry woman and that's not beautiful, and I was taught by the billboards that women show up in a different way.
Mm.
And so when I disable that judgment, and it no longer disables me.
Cool.
I think another aspect that people come in with is they don't have the capacity to hold joy for very long. It's almost like a muscle, right? This capacity to go deeper into your happiness, to go deeper into your ecstatic state, to remain open and creative is almost like a muscle. So sometimes people come in and they're so used to this sort of of life, or just like a mundaneness, that much ecstasy and that much joy can be a little confronting. So I think that there's sometimes a little bit of a limitation there. We don't let ourselves be that happy for that long because of judgment or because of self-talk.
Well, that's I was going to ask. So that would seem to be very counterintuitive, that we don't allow ourselves to be happy for that long. And why might that be?
Well, I think everybody has a different story and a different reason, but it's always some form of self-talk, some form of, I don't deserve this. I'm not worth this. You know, there's so much suffering in the world. How dare I be happy, this happy for this long? Or, you know, somebody who I know is really unhappy, and so therefore I can't be happy because I have to dim my light so that they won't feel bad.
What comes up for me is, I don't have time to be happy for that long. It's like, you know, it's okay to be happy for a little while, but then we got to get back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And that presumes something about the nature of work.
Right.
So help me out with that.
I know that there's a sociologist somewhere that basically really went deep into this work ethic that we have. The idea that it's more valuable and worthy as a person to be in a state of focused, what's the word I'm looking at? Efforting. Focused
exertion.
Exertion is more valuable than ecstatic exertion. Somebody somewhere told us that, and we all bought it.
And, yeah, we sure did. I did.
You know, joyousness, I'm trying to imply that we should not try to accomplish anything ever or be totally ineffective all the time and just be running around yelling yeehaw. I'm saying that you can be as effective and efficient in a joyous state.
Mm. Wow.
That is a huge wound in our culture.
Cultural wound.
Yeah.
This is why when I speak of what we're all doing together and what we're creating, and when I say gather the tribe, it is serious business, because I do feel like we are responsible. We're being called into great purpose, a cultural shift. I've experienced this also, this I don't have time. And as a parent, I also go, I don't have time not to be playful. That is serious business. My son needs me to be playful. My friends need me to be playful. And I also was hearing, Raina, when you were sharing the word valuable. What is valuable? What do we value? Playfulness is medicine. It, you know, like that saying, fight for your right to party. Well, you know, is it fight for your right to be a whole human being? And when we do that, when we allow the playfulness, we get to go back to work and be the light. And who there at work doesn't need all of us to come back whole into our relationships and our family and return fed?
So when we get through this threshold, this gateway of reconnecting with our whole selves, with our bodies, and stepping outside the lines and shaking the vibrations, you know, that are in our cellular memory loose, mm-hmm. and we come back, and you know, and that ends right at 10 o'clock, right? And we go home and we go to bed, and the next morning we wake up and we go to work.
Doesn't end.
Well, so this is like, how, that's what I'm asking. Like, does it fundamentally change, or does it fundamentally change our job? Does it change what we see our job as? Do we quit our jobs and do something else? What happens?
It's like, it's just filter on reality. It's just perspective, right? You can do the exact same thing one day in one state of mind, and then do the exact same thing the next day in a different state of mind, and you'll have a completely different experience. So it's really about, okay, am I going to approach the world from this place of playful interest, or am I going to approach the world from a place of judgment and efforting? You can have the most boring job in the world, but if you have like creative ways of seeing it and creative ways of interacting with the people that you work with and be playful with that, you're going to have a playful life.
Rainey shared creative.
Yes.
And I think, so one of the things I definitely want to share is I did have to merge from this. I think I was a playful little girl. I must have been. I was a child once, right? And then all of a sudden life got really gnarly serious. And I think it has been for most of us if we've survived into our 40s, and gnarly for our generation in a different way, like fear of connection, fear of playfulness, too serious. But I went through this period of time where my creativity got sucked out of me. And for me, having to move from this very serious place in life, thinking that only people who have money and time are allowed to play, it's a luxury. Dropping into the dance community was this invitation into this rich, nourishing life. No matter where I am, whether it's with my family or in intimate relationship or in larger community or returning to my cubicle, my executive office, I'm not changing my job. I'm owning my experience. And I'm able to drop in and accept ownership. What experience do I want to have in my life? How do I want to dance my dance at work? This place you mentioned about the light, like joy. How much of that am I going to allow in? How much am I going to allow myself to create that in a place of discomfort where the air conditioning is blazing and I'm uncomfortable, I'm cold, and the lights are flickering at a speed, a fluorescent light that's irritating me. And when I start cracking open and having a full experience, how do I show up in this world that's not so comfortable? That's maybe not ideal. How do I create this way of being more of who I really am, more of what I really want? And then how do we bring that light out into our world, into this larger picture, and really share it? And it is interesting to me exploring that the light is as bright as dark, and as deep and wide as the dark is. How deep do we want to travel in it? You know, and so the dance cracks those pieces of us open.
So something that strikes me that a consequence of owning your whole experience brings you to a place where you have new tools with which to engage the world, right? You mentioned, Wendy, several times in our conversation, this disabling process that happens. And when you are less disabled, you are more able. And it seems like the potential exists for you to find yourself in that uncomfortable condition and have more tools at your disposal to change it, to shift it.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I'm not taught and conditioned to embrace challenges. But when I learn to embrace them through my body, it's deep, it's rich. So for me, challenge and discomfort, when I can see and feel my body start shutting down and my nervous system start heightening up and this fight starts happening, I don't want to fight. I want to love.
Life comes at you pretty fast, and you're doing the best you can. But maybe you could use a little help. Are you looking for answers or feeling a little stuck? Something nagging you that you and your doctor can't quite explain? Or maybe you're looking to enhance your game or improve your performance at work? Consider a visit with John Carosella at The Shamanist. Whether you need a little guidance or even a little miracle, John can help. Visit in person or connect by phone or Skype. Schedule a rune, oracle, or tarot reading. Experience a shamanic counseling session, or a Reju Keto or shamanic healing session for body and soul. Experience more of your world and yourself. The sky's the limit when you tap into the realities that are just beyond our sight. Mention this ad and receive a special gift when you book your first session with John. For a little help, or maybe a little miracle, theshamanist.com.
I was watching you and noticing, and you were saying it's hard to find the words, I was stricken by the difference between the right brain and the left brain. And I was thinking that as we were talking, Let's see. Your right brain was getting more activated, the more creative side. And the more creative side, as it gets more activated, makes it much harder to be linear, much harder to find words, much harder to make sense. And I think that there is a little bit of a fear of, like, this doesn't make sense. And immediately our left brain comes in and says, okay, I'm going to make this make sense, right?
Yes, that definitely happens.
Right.
That definitely happens.
If we can let go of the need for things to always make sense, especially in particularly in the realm of play, we're inviting the mystery in. And when we invite the mystery in, we invite in that which we do not already know. And that's really what I'm imagining everybody is hoping to gain, is like more access to the divine, more access to the mystery.
Well, and this is particularly interesting to me because I realize that, you know, my life is driven by optimizing for growth. It has been, has historically been, optimized for growth, optimized for growth, optimized for growth. But intrinsic to that attitude has been that I know how to optimize for growth, that I know how to align myself for growth. And what it circumscribes out is the mystery.
Yes.
Right? That there's stuff I don't know.
Right.
That can bring, that I can receive, right? See, it's a very active principle, attitude where I'm going to go get it. I'm going to craft it. I'm going to drive it into reality, into my reality. And that's not, you know, that doesn't, I don't always have the perspective to create the optimal path for growth for me. And so play is that area where it doesn't appear to have value because I can't see how it crafts my growth.
Okay, well, I've just got to jump in here and say that, first of all, would you agree with the statement that an optimalized brain is one that operates both on the left and right hemisphere?
This is absolutely the path that I'm learning. This is absolutely true, yeah.
So when you are needing to make sense of and know how to do everything, you're only using half of your brain. It's not optimal.
And I want to share and jump in. Jump. So I want to, it's so exciting. It is a little bit scary, this what we call movement medicine, and I often don't like to call it dance because people think,
right,
they get in there, no, I need to know how to dance.
Right.
No, I don't know how to dance. Right. And I think when we are in our no, when I'm in my no, in my head, I'm in my ego, I want to control, I'm missing the magic. To me, it all boils down to the power of presence, whether it's me allowing myself to be with my terrifying woundedness from intimate relationship and breathe. I'm not going to run. I'm not going to numb out. I'm not going to listen to the judgments and my past experience. I want to have an experience in the now. I feel scared. I want to run. Just be with it. Just breathe with it. Just dance with it. Dance in the moment. Be in the moment. Just listening. Deep listening. And when I can listen to myself, I can now be brave and courageous enough to hear your own pain, not try to fix it, not try to change you, be with you now, and allow. And I had to stay, not run. That's a big piece I find in our culture. Let's go find what we need. Let's go get what we want. Let's create it. It's definitely not here, and that's a lie. It's here. It's here right now in this moment, whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable.
I want to share a personal experience around needing to make things happen, right? And I want to thread this all back into the importance of play. I had a whole chapter, decade of my life, where I essentially was making things happen. And everything that happened in my life was because I made it happen. And we won't go into the details, but long story short, what happened to me was I actually had a full adrenaline crash. My adrenal system just said, we're done. And I completely crashed and had to take like a whole year off of doing anything. And it's taught me that there's a different way to do things, right? There's making things happen and there's letting things happen. And I mean, I can already hear everybody's voice of like, oh, I'm just going to let everything happen and not make anything happen. It's not about that, but it's understanding that there is a choice to make something happen or to let something happen, and to notice if you're making it happen or if you're letting it happen.
if you're letting it happen, can you also be making it happen while you're letting it happen? In other words, this the co-creative dance thing?
Yes. This is the thing that's so interesting. Right. So it's like you can...
I say come to a contact dance class and experience what it's like to lead, and connect.
Contact is the best example, exactly. Because, yeah,
magic.
Because when you're letting something happen, you're also making it happen. Because by leaning away, somebody's going to lean towards. And by leaning towards, somebody's going to lean away. You know, so it does. It's like magnets. Maybe that's a better...
Yeah. And this and the playfulness through contact dance, you know, is also intimacy and that connection that gets created. Can I play without judging and really be in that moment and be fed and nourished by the playfulness?
I've been walking down this path quite a bit more often with more awareness of the receptive principle. You know, it's Newton's law, right? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So for every impulsion, there's something that's receiving that impulsion. For every act of doing, there's a canvas on which it is being done. And I think the challenge, and for me, the really exciting part of my personal development now, is when I realize that both of those things are happening in every moment, in every element of my experience.
Yes.
And it's really the awareness of that, right? That I am doing, and I'm also receiving all of that that's happening. And, you know, the microphones are reacting to my voice, but they're also pushing on the air, right? And they're sending signals, so they're doing as well. And, you know, this is one of the challenges of being in the present moment. What the heck does that mean, right? And I think, for me, what I'm starting to realize is being in the present moment is realizing that I can receive in that moment as well as act. I can experience the divine feminine, the receptive part of the universe. And I can witness other people receiving as opposed to wondering what they're going to do. Right? And the narrower the time horizon, the closer I get to being in the present moment, the more my attention can be applied to that dynamic instead of what's the plan.
This is exactly why dance is such a potent tool for arriving in the present moment, because what's the one thing that's always in the present moment? Your body. Your body is always here now. It can't be anywhere else. Your mind is almost always in the future or the past. But dance allows you to tap into this thing that I like to call the perfect tool for measuring the now. It's always measuring the now. Sounds, temperature, what do you see, what do you feel? Constantly, constantly measuring the now. So this is this awesome tool that you have to be totally present. All you got to do is show up and be in it.
That's very cool. That's very cool.
Yeah. While you're sharing, I'm John, like you're expressing your experience and how it's working and the exploration. And I've found through sitting in Wisdom Circle and being in conscious dance community and getting what piece of us is a quote-unquote story, what pieces of us are judgment, that exploration of our body wisdom, allowing this awareness to come through, that everything becomes play for me now. My tears, my anger, my sadness, it's all playful. It may not be fun, but the dance produces this ability and this connection in our language, our speaking vocal language, and the truth of our bodies, and that combination is really powerful.
All right, so as we wind up, any last thoughts you want to share, Raina?
Well, I'd like to share that if anybody is interested in play and in creating a greater capacity for bliss and joy in their life, I would really recommend coming to dance and also coming to contact improv. The reason why I particularly love contact improv is because it puts you in contact with others and it helps you to be present in that. It's a real presence practice because you're in physical relation to another body, you have to continually listen with your body to the other body. And so it keeps you in the now with every movement because you don't know what's going to happen. It's improvisation. There's no moves. There's no prescribed way to do it. So what that forces you to do is stay present with what's happening right now because you don't know what's going to happen next. And it's an embodied way to dance with the mystery. It's also an embodied way to step out of time. I think that one of the big, you know, you talked about, I can't play, I don't have time, right? I think a really important thing for our sanity as a species is to allow ourselves periods of timelessness where we just don't track the time. We're not paying attention to how much time we have or not. We don't even know what time it is. So contact improv can help you be in that timelessness because it slows down your physical experience so much that you can escape from time. The final thing I want to say about play, and it's actually very important, you can see it in nature. Animals learn about their capacity as beings through play. They play with each other as youngsters, and they learn about what can they do with their mouths, with their bodies, with their strengths. And human beings have continually become more and more and more amazing in their physical capacity because we continue to play. We learn about what our edges are. And so playing will actually increase your capacity in the world on many different levels because you'll learn that your edges are not where you think they are.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Raina. Wendy, any last thoughts?
Yeah, what comes up for me is just I invite people to disable judgment by owning your judgment and bring it into what we call a container, which are the spaces that we create together to explore safely. And when I say the word safely, I want to say just because you don't feel safe doesn't mean that you're not safe. And that's an edge.
Yeah.
And I'm also open to, you know, sharing my contact information and for people to call and say, hey, I'm coming to this dance and I'm scared, or, you know, and we do have a closing circle after to be able to express with words. And it creates a community of people who are exploring and exploring all of who we really are, what's coming up for us in life, whether it be somebody close to you has passed away and you're moving through grieving, or you realize there's these hang-ups in life that we have. I have them. I'm hung up. I'm stuck. It's really hard to get unstuck alone, but we're definitely a courageous and deep and powerful community, like a tribe. Then we get to explore as a tribe, and that return home that's not dependent on what you're being told through religion or a belief or a job, but that you get a space to be who you really are and explore.
Excellent. Ladies, thank you so much for an enlightening, fun, and inspiring conversation.
Yeah. Thank you. I love this gathering. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And we'll be back.
Enjoying today's show? Want to share it with a friend? Or maybe you've missed one of our previous programs. Well, you can always find the archives of our past shows on fireflywillows.com/live. Stop by and check out Mildred Lynn McDonald's previous programs or shows from one of our other hosts, John Carosella and Heisi Lutmers. Our live call-in shows are available too. Join us. Nice to have you back. From dance and community to balance. Next up is Mildred Lynn's Mini Bites, healing ideas to snack on. Mildred Lynn will share with us some tips on staying balanced, connected, and honest.
All good characteristics to keep in mind as you dance through life.
Okay, here we go.
In this episode of Mini Bites, Healing Ideas to Snack On, we're going to explore my 5 personal balancer questions that I use a couple of times a year to attract more balance, inner peace, connection, and perhaps even more great conversation, fun, and community into my life. In short, they keep me honest. They may also be useful to someone who's close to you, someone who's struggling to figure out who they are or what they want to do with their life. To start off, I'd like to ask you a question, and it's a question that sometimes I ask myself. When was the last time that you had an open and honest conversation with yourself? If you're like most people, you might not even know what to ask, and that's okay because I'm going to give you some questions.
Take these questions and tuck them away in a safe place so you can pull them out on a rainy day when you're curled up on the sofa with a nice cup of tea. It will be a special time that you will put aside for a healing conversation between you and you. To get the ball rolling, here is a question that always gets people's time and attention. If I'm not following my heart's passion or what makes me happy, what am I following? If you probe a little deeper, what this question is really asking is, and what you want to ask yourself, is, am I wearing a mask every day? If the answer is yes, then you might want to explore the last time when you felt free enough not to wear a mask. For some people, the answer might be when you were, let's see, 7 years old and playing with some friends. Once you have the snapshot, try to remember how it felt in the moment. Perhaps time and space disappeared. For sure, you most likely felt free, alive, and maskless. It's really important to zoom in on this heart-centered feeling, because once you capture it, or recapture it, your next opportunity is to cultivate it in your life today. For those of you who would like to go a little further with this exploration, you're more than welcome to read my blog post, Are You Masking Your Heart's Passion? At mildredlin.blogspot.com. The next thing I'd like to share with you is some field research that I've collected over the years as a life coach and a healing conversationalist. It illustrates 5 reasons why people might choose not to follow their heart's passion. As I go through them, you might want to see if any sound familiar in your life. I know that 2 definitely applied to me. About 25% of people choose not to express their heart's passion because they feel that pursuing their dream is uncomfortable for them, for others, or both. I experienced this myself when I left high tech to pursue a life coaching program in San Diego and energy medicine. At the time, some people in my life didn't know what to make of me, and I suspect that I might have been a little bit out there for some of them. Well, maybe I still am. Basically, I learned that if I had the strength and the courage to follow my heart, then the people in my life who truly appreciated me and applauded my happiness would support me no matter what. And do you know what? This is what happened. For about 45% of people, the reason not to express a heart's passion may be related to timing. This group wears a mask to hide an aspect of themselves that they don't wish to reveal to anybody, at least not yet. From my experience, I found that waiting for the right time may be an excuse to procrastinate. If you're in this group, your sentences will be peppered with the words, I'll do this when. At the end of the day, it's not a very satisfying way to go through life, because what you're really training yourself to do is put everything on hold. On hold until ... About 15% of people wear a mask because their heart's passion is not a convenient fit into their life, a life that they've created and are heavily invested in. For example, a mainstream professional, let's say someone in healthcare, discovers that he has a burning passion for pantomime, not as a hobby, but as a life's vocation. Darn, just after investing all that time and money into education, identity, lifestyle, and setting up office. At some point, usually between 2 and 3 in the morning, his heart and his lifestyle will collide. What I've learned is that it doesn't have to be all or nothing. If your heart's passion needs a little time and nurturing to get out of the box, then take baby steps. For example, if you feel that your life purpose revolves around grapes, no need to jump and buy a vineyard. Just start reading about grapes, buying grapes, collecting plates with grapes on them, painting grapes, anything as long as you're incorporating something to do with grapes into your life. About 10% of people wear a mask to hide their authentic self because they don't understand or get their heart's passion. They may even feel quite invaded, as if their heart's passion has chosen them, sometimes even against their will. In essence, they're really trying to talk themselves out of who they really are. So as you can imagine, the self-talk on this journey can be quite funny. This journey applies to me. I tried to repress my calling for life coaching and energy medicine for years. I didn't understand what it was about, nor did I value it, and for sure it wasn't mainstream. On a comical note, my self-talk was that it would take me about 20, 30, or even 40 years to catch up in this field, so why even try? But at the end of the day, that was only fear talking. And as soon as I decided to let go of my head and follow my heart, everything fell into place. About 5% of people wear a mask because they get caught up in an endless cycle of thinking things over and over and over again, just like a feedback loop. They live in their head, and they don't pause long enough to connect with their heart. If you find yourself plagued with what-ifs, 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 followed by a generous helping of more what-ifs, then one of the best ways to center and connect with your heartbeat is through physical activity. You really need to do something active to get you out of your head and create a space for feelings and inspiration to come in. If you're looking for more questions, what I would really recommend is getting a copy of Debbie Ford's book called The Right Questions. In the book, there's 10 questions that I guarantee will keep you busy for at least a weekend. So thank you very much for listening. This is Mildred Lynn McDonald. I hope that you'll stay with us for the rest of the show.
A personal tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi-C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi-C at tarotbyhic.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com.
Welcome back. Some interesting tips from Mildred Lynn there. And sadly, we note the passing of Debbie Ford recently, who was a pioneer in developing the shadow work, working with the shadow. It is good that we have community to rely on and elders and leaders to help us. In our next segment, Hi-C speaks with Yeshe Rabbit, a local leader who is the founding high priestess of the Come As You Are Coven and is co-owner of Sacred Well in Oakland, California.
And this conversation coming up is from Hi-C's December show. They'll talk about the difference between giving gifts and making offerings. And Rabbit will share a meditation and a practice so you can make your own offering that will serve you in your evolution and manifestation of who you may want to become.
Well, let's get to it.
Make a sacred offering to the gods of infinitesimal detail.
We return to our conversation with Yeshe Rabbit.
You know, the word sacrifice means to make sacred. So when you were talking about taking the time to go down to the store and get this, or like if I'm setting up my altar and I realize I need flowers, I will make a special trip to the store to get flowers for the altar. But I will not say, oh, well, since I'm going to be at the store anyway, let me go ahead and make this little list of other things that I need, and I'll pick up some groceries and stuff too, and I'll make sure to grab some flowers while I'm there as well. Because if I specifically set aside the time and the energy to go down to the store and get those flowers for the altar, in essence, what I'm doing is I'm making the act of going to shop and buy flowers a sacred act.
Right.
So I'm making a sacrifice by making the motivation and the energy behind what I'm doing sacred and not combining it with other things to where it's something that simply is convenient or a side note to something else that I'm doing just mm-hmm. because I'm going to the store.
Yes.
And I think that's what's also important is, again, it comes back to that motivation. And sacrifice doesn't mean something elaborate all of the time, nor something painful, like you said. It just means approaching it and doing it with an act of sacredness and an intention of sacredness behind why and what you're doing and the purpose that you're doing it for, rather than, well, if I can slip in time or a way to get that thing that I need for the God, I'll do it.
Right.
You know, and I think also, like when you're talking about the people with 2-year-old kids and, you know, all that kind of stuff, I think people also get a little bit stuck in thinking that offerings are something physical. And I don't know that the gods are necessarily looking down in judgment about, are you offering me the right thing?
Right.
So much as they're looking at what's your motivation and, you know, is your intention pure behind what you're doing? So the person that has the 2-year-old kids, the sacrifice I would say that the gods would be looking for would be more, are you willing to sacrifice 5 minutes of sleep time in order to simply come and sit after the kids are in bed and commune with me at your altar?
Exactly.
And that is both a sacrifice of 5 minutes of sleep time that are probably very precious to someone with kids.
Yes,
like that.
Absolutely.
But it's also an offering, because it's a pure motivation, but it's an offering. This is what I have to give. This is all I have to offer. But for the gods, that's enough.
That's right.
We get caught up in ego that thinks it needs to be something more, something better, something greater, something whatever. And if we stop looking at it both from a material standpoint of what am I offering, as well as is it enough versus my motivation and my intention is what makes it enough, quote unquote, then that is all that the gods are really asking of us. And that to me is you don't have to sacrifice getting a babysitter to go to the store to get the right kind of food to offer to the god kind of thing,
right,
versus simply sacrifice 5 minutes of sleep time that before you go to bed that you would love to have, but are willing to give that and offer that to the god instead.
Right.
Instead of holding on to it for yourself.
Right.
We hope you're enjoying this broadcast of Firefly Willows LIVE on Blog Talk Radio. For information on Firefly Willows, please explore our website, fireflywillows.com, or like us on Facebook.
So as we move into our next segment, Yeshe Rabbit is going to lead us through an offering ritual that you can perform on your own anytime that you choose. And it is a process that helps you to tap into and express the generosity that you have in order to move beyond egocentric aspects within yourself.
Attachments to our fears or our exaltation. The most precious gift any of us has to offer is time, because it is the one thing in our lives that is in fact limited. So begin this ritual by choosing to set aside an amount of time to do each part so that you can deepen into the practice with a sense that giving of your time is the ground of the ritual. Thus, the ritual that will come after will be rooted in the offering of this most precious commodity. This is a three-part offering ritual. You can do it in one whole day, or you can do it on three separate days. The first part of the ritual is going to involve the preparation of a physical offering. The second part of the ritual is going to involve the preparation of an artistic offering. And the third part of the ritual is going to involve the preparation of a meditational offering of self. In a certain sense, one might look at this process of offering through a shamanic lens or through a Buddhist lens as the act of feeding your demons. However, you can choose to, instead of giving this offering to an embodied deity, give it to a situation, another human being, either in person or spiritually at a distance. Or you might choose to do altar work with this ritual and work with a deity that you find complex, disturbing, or frightening. Begin by identifying a situation or person in your life that you find difficult, vexatious, or troublesome. Take the time to think about this person or situation. And if you choose to work with a deity in this offering ritual, identify the deity who most closely represents the energy of the situation at hand. So, for example, you might, if you were thinking about a legal situation that you're dealing with, decide that you will appeal to Justitia, the Roman goddess of justice. You may find that you will give this offering to the spirit of the person who wronged you. You may find that you will give this offering on behalf of all those who have gone through your similar circumstance. The main point is that you identify exactly who this offering will be for, and you make that concrete in your mind and in your intention. In the first part of the ritual, dedicate the merit of what you are about to do to that circumstance, that being, or those beings that you're choosing to give this offering to. Make a humble and simple prayer in which you deliver the offering. I, Yesha Rabbit, stand here before you, person, situation, or deity, and I give this offering that myself, all beings, and others might experience the wisdom of this set of circumstances of or of your power or of your presence. The first part of the offering is to prepare something from scratch, a food item, or perhaps some kind of a beverage that you've squeezed by hand. Perhaps it's a libation of beer or wine that you brewed yourself. Perhaps it's a concoction of oils and herbs. Be creative and design an offering that represents the very best of your skills. Make it purposeful and beautiful. If it's a food or drink offering, arrange it artfully on the plate or pour it into a beautiful glass or vessel. Take the time to adorn the offering, placing flowers, leaves, or fresh herbs upon it. If it's a concoction that you've mixed up of essential oils, flowers, and herbs, take the time to place it in a glass vessel or crystal that will allow the beauty of the concoction to be seen. Stand before an altar upon which you have placed items that represent the situation, person, persons, or deity to whom you are making this offering. And then, softly and gently and in a measured way, process forth with your offering held at your heart to that altar. Standing before that altar, speak to the individual or individuals or the deity or the circumstance at hand, describing the offering that you have made in reverent words. Here I stand before you, bearing this humble gift of fresh fruits, of wine that I brewed from fruits I grew upon my own trees or vines. I ask that you receive this offering with the fullness of my heart, my joyful gift to you, and that it be pleasing to you. In the next portion, you will think about that situation at hand or that person or persons or deity, and you will create an artistic representation of the wisdom that they represent in your life. So, for example, let's say you've chosen a conflict with a friend as the situation at hand. Envision that friend. Envision the moment of that conflict. Take the time to find the beauty in that moment and the wisdom in that moment. The beauty of that moment might be that even though she stood before you angry and wrathful, shouting or arguing or crying, that you were able to look upon her and still notice the beauty of the curve of her cheek or the passion in her words. Think about the wisdom that came forward from that situation. You learned more about this person, her sensitivities, her triggers. Think about the vast depth of friendship that is possible when we acknowledge all parts of a person, even the parts that we find challenging or troublesome. Write that, or speak that, or sing that, or dance that, or enact that wisdom and beauty in front of the altar, in front of the image you've conjured, and give it as an offering from your heart. It's a spontaneous creation, and it will only happen this once. Make it worthwhile. Make it real and deep. In the third part of this ritual, you will then sit and close your eyes and go into a meditative state or trance. And in this meditative state or trance, you will call into your vision the circumstance, person, persons, or deity that is the focal point of this enactment. And you will stand there in this vision before them, stripped naked, your clothing gone, your mirrors and masks gone and cast aside. You stand there as your full self, and you say, I have given you the fruits of my labors. I have given you the art of my spirit. And now I give you the only other thing that I can give, which is my very self. Envision taking all the best parts of yourself and placing them in service to this circumstance or person. You might even go so far as to shamanically envision the deity form ritually dismembering you and consuming the parts of your body. Give with joy. Give with non-attachment. Give with selflessness. Make sure all is consumed in this offering. Envision yourself in servitude toward the greater good of this being or situation. Give it completely. Empty yourself in this act. And then give one last thing, which is your gratitude for having been able to perform this enactment. Invite the deity or person, persons or circumstance to take your gratitude also. Nothing is left behind. Nothing is wasted. All has been consumed in this reverent offering. Give thanks to your own inner teacher for whatever wisdom has come from this or will come from it. Take some time later in a journal or in a personal meditation at your own altar to reflect upon this which you created, this ritual which you performed, and any insights that may have returned to you after performing the ritual. Often, the giving of this ritual will transform the circumstance at hand. We don't do this ritual because we want to change our own outcome. We do this ritual because the comfort of the other person, circumstance, or the deity is of paramount importance to us. In stripping away our own ego attachments to outcome, we generate the potential for the best possible outcome for all beings, and that includes ourselves. Therefore, we are no longer separate from the circumstance, from the person, from the deity, but in fact, we locate ourselves, the person, circumstance, and deity within the great matrix of generosity that gives forth this entire universe, that accepts without critique or comment all that is dead, dying, and decaying back to be regenerated and transformed. And in this act, we dedicate ourselves in a selfless way to the highest benefit of all beings, emblematized by this one situation, which, until we had this perspective, seemed so important. I wish you all very great peace. I wish you all harmony and bliss. And when peace, harmony, and bliss are not present, I wish you the wisdom and discernment to do what must be done to restore them. Blessed be, blessed be, blessed be.
Welcome back. That was a beautiful ritual. Thanks to Yeshe Rabbit and Hi-C for sharing that with us. I think that we all find something powerful and beautiful in sharing, in the nature of generosity. It connects us to the divine.
Well, somehow that's got to relate to dogs. So up next, John's going to share with us how that connection happened for him. And this segment will come from his July Convergence show.
I guess it was a pretty typical evening around here. I'd been meditating, doing some deep journey work, contemplating the nature of God and the divine. I was contemplating the limits of my own awareness and what connection I had with God and what connection God had with me and through me into the world. I was asking questions like, how much of me was my higher self? What was the nature of my higher self anyway? And what was the difference between my higher self and God? Was there separation? There must be, because my higher self has a lot of my personality in it, minus my dysfunctions, I figure. And God was, well, more than that. I took a break. I came in from the fire to refresh myself with a little something. And as I grabbed that little something out of the fridge, our trusty family dog, always on alert for an important mission, was at my feet. Of course. I looked down at him, smiled, and said, "No, Tucker, this is not for doggies. This is for Daddy." And as usual, he looked up at me with friendly mischief in his eyes, trying to convince me to change my mind. But this time, something miraculous happened. This time I saw something I had never seen before, and it brought a whole bunch of things suddenly into focus. I saw Tucker not as a dog, but as divine consciousness, experiencing reality through a dog's body, through a dog's equipment, so to speak. Just as I was God, experiencing reality through my equipment, my body, my fears and dysfunctions and habits and patterns, Tucker was divine consciousness too, trying to express itself and experience itself. This moment, this realization was not an abstraction. It was very real and visceral and grounded and present. I was catapulted back to a common activity that Tucker and I share. We have a beautiful, bountiful orange tree in our backyard. From the time Tucker was a youngster, I would go pluck myself an orange, sit down on a lawn chair, peel it, and eat it. Of course, as often as not, Tucker was there with me. And being a dog, he would nose his way into the action. One for you, one for me, back and forth with each slice of the orange. After a while, I would tire, or just be full of oranges, but Tucker never seemed quite satisfied. Eventually, I would pluck an orange and break it in half, or just crack the peel, and leave the whole thing for him as I went inside and pursued other human antics. Tucker loves oranges. Eventually, he would learn to pluck the oranges from the tree himself. But there was always something subtly different about sitting together. He enjoyed picking his own fruit and eating it. He enjoyed the fruit if I picked it and peeled it and gave the whole thing to him. But there was nothing he enjoyed more. Nothing, honestly, that he enjoys more than one for you and one for me. Suddenly, it all made sense. He's not a dog looking for food. He's divine consciousness looking for a shared experience. What is the purpose of God in creation? It's been theorized that it's all about God having the opportunity to experience himself in and through the infinite diversity of the creation. So there he was, peeking out at me through Tucker's eyes. And when I greeted him that way, there was a smile of recognition and almost a sigh of relief, as if he had been waiting a very long time for me to see him and greet him and share with him in that way. When I abstract myself upwards from the mundane, profane experience of every day, I realize that there is a great force of consciousness that is squeezed perilously and imperfectly through my small and limited physical self. And there are great swaths of it that I glimpse only erratically and imperfectly, and often that I won't let through. Things like forgiveness and charity and joy. What gets in the way are things like immaturity, petulance, and self-righteousness, and fear, mostly fear. And looking at Tucker, I saw that there could be no fear. There could be just the differences between us, between our instrumentation, so to speak, and the delight in experiencing the same thing, a slice of orange, through these different instruments, and trying to share what that's like with each other, simply by being together and enjoying the experience together. Then what unfolded for me was a greater landscape of the divine. Everything around me became the divine, became divine consciousness experiencing. The orange tree was divine consciousness experiencing the creation through the instrument of an orange tree. The empty wine bottle became divine consciousness experiencing what it was like to be a wine bottle, formed from sand, assessed for purity and clarity and reliability, and filled with an elixir to be enjoyed, but patiently waiting to be tapped, to be called upon to pour out libations. And I stepped back in horror at my own now foolish inability to recognize the divine in the wine bottle. The Lakota people talk about the grandfathers that are the rocks that they put in the fire for the sweat lodge. They say that the stone people are among the wisest because they have great knowledge, great wisdom. I considered suddenly how this observation might be true. A rock has been the divine experiencing reality for a very, very long time. It has the lens, the experience of a geologic age, and yet a presence in this reality, on this planet. How much can a rock experience? I don't know. But I realized that the ever-increasing expression of life, the increasing complexity of life on this planet, might be God's way of adapting, growing, and getting more stimulation from his experiment. I realize that's probably why God is such a fan of sexual reproduction. All that mixing and experiencing from all those new and ever so slightly different perspectives. All of the pollen mixing in the air from all the trees and all the flowers. And all of the antics of all the animals, courting and mating and having young. And apart from reproduction, I realize that's probably why sex feels so amazing for us humans. There's something about the mingling of experience, the sharing of experience, that reaches some kind of pinnacle in sex. And great sex leads us further out into that rarefied territory. How do we experience the divine in our lives? It suddenly became a lot easier when I realized that everything around me is the divine trying to experience me. We're not alone. Far from it. We're all in this together. We're all a slice of the divine consciousness in this soup of togetherness so that we can come to know it and in the process come to know ourselves.
So we're all in this together, and it's been a real privilege and pleasure to have been part of producing 50 shows for this community that we're building. So thank you to all of you out there who have been listening and have been supporting us all along the way.
Yes, we appreciate your enthusiasm. We appreciate your listening.
Can you believe we've got 50 shows under our belt?
No, it snuck up on me, actually. I was getting ready for this week's show, and I went, oh my gosh, this is our 50th Sunday, and I think maybe we should say something about that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So we have more to come, right?
That's right.
Our 51st show will be the
Tuesday.
And it happens to be my new show, A Shamanic Life. How convenient.
March 5th at 8 p.m.
Yeah, we have a variety of guests and some interesting music.
Lots of fun stuff happening on A Shamanic Life, so be sure to tune in. So on behalf of Hi-C and Mildred Lin, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us.
Thanks a lot, everyone.